Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everybody, this is Klaatu, and today I want to talk about the Dreamland Realms of H.P. Lovecraft. Previous episode of this mini-series, we talked about the Serenarian Sea, which is in the north region of the Dreamland Realms, and contains three, possibly four, of the kingdoms of the six kingdoms of the Dreamlands. Those being, by my estimation, Kled, the abandoned and ancient, yet perfectly preserved by the gods, jungle kingdom of Kled, Uthnargai, with the Palace of 70 Delights at Sedafes, the sky-floating Serenian, and the fourth, or whatever number, because I'm making a guess that these are primary kingdoms, but what I'm calling possibly the fourth is Inquinoc. And that's what we're going to cover today, Inquinoc. So Inquinoc is about 2 or 3 days farther along the Serenarian Sea, after the Jagged Isle, which, if you'll recall, is sort of an outpost of the Moon Beings, where they've started to colonize, probably for no good purpose other than to experiment on humans. But that itself was about 20 days from Uthnargai. So we're about 23 days out along the Serenarian Sea from what we would consider modern civilization within the Six Kingdoms. Inquinoc is known as a dark land, and this is partly because it is so far north, and the north tends to be fairly dark most, if not all, of the time. I mean, not pitch, but dim, dark, dull. So Inquinoc's dark coastline holds a city of the same name. So Inquinoc is, as far as I can tell, both the region and the primary city. It's an old city made of bulbous domes and fantastic spires of onyx. The city is surrounded by black walls with flutings and arabesque of inlaid gold. So black and gold are its primary colors, if you kind of look at it from afar. Tall and many-windowed are its houses, and carved on every side with flowers and patterns whose dark symmetries dazzle the eye with a beauty more poignant than light. Some end in swelling domes that taper to a point, others in terraced pyramids, whereupon rose-clustered minarets display every phase of strangeness and imagination. The city walls are low and contain several gates along the wall, so there are many entrances into it, each one under a great arch rising high above the general level and capped by the head of a god chiseled with that same skill displayed in the monstrous face on distant Granic. On a hill in the center there's a 16-angled tower, greater than all the rest, bearing a high pinnacled belfry resting on a flattened dome. And remember this belfry, it's an important one, and we'll come back to it shortly, but this is the Temple of the Elder Ones, and it is ruled by an old high priest, sad with inner secrets. Now, I don't know why there are so many openings in the city walls of Inquinoc, the city. I'm assuming it's because it's so remote that they don't feel like they have to bolster their city that all that much against, you know, invaders or any reason that a traditional wall would be built up around an old city. So I'm assuming that their remoteness leaves a little bit of room for them to be more open than a lot of other cities in a more maybe dangerous region. Not that Inquinoc is really, really secure, but you'll see that they are in a pretty ideal situation in terms of unwanted visitors, because they've got the Serenarian Sea between them and the rest of the world on their south border, on some other border, and I want to say it's the eastern border. I could be getting that. Western border, I believe. I could be getting that confused. But upon one of their borders, a huge cliff and mountain range exists between them and another land, which we'll talk a lot about, which I'm not going to even mention yet to keep you in due anticipation. So at intervals, you'll hear through the city the clang of a strange bell that shivers over the Onyx City, answered each time by a peal of mystic music made up of horns, viols, and chanting voices. Natives of the city of Inquinoc stop whatever they're doing, and they bow to observe the ceremony. And then from a row of tripods on a gallery around the high dome of the temple, there bursts flares of flame in some specific rhythm, and the fanfare, all of this, the music and these flames that are leaping about from all around the dome, it announces priests, and these priests come out from their temples and perform this little ceremony and then kind of disappear for the rest of the day. We'll talk a little bit more about the temple in a minute, but that's a daily occurrence. The reason they do this is that they are keeping the rhythm of the Great Ones, as set forth in scrolls even older than the Pentateuch manuscripts. Now, I can't help it, as I've said several times before, one of my favorite pantheons to use in games is the Lord Dunsany Pagana pantheon. So when I hear that there are these priests worshipping these ancient gods, these old great gods, and performing rituals to keep the rhythm of the old ones, the first thing that leaps to mind is, of course, Skarl. And Skarl, you may remember from the Pagana episodes, if you happened to catch those on this series, he or she is the god who beats the drum to keep Mana Yud-Sushai asleep. And the Skarl beats the drum in perfect rhythm and must not and cannot stop beating that drum lest Mana Yud-Sushai awaken and devour the whole of reality, of the universe, of the multiverse, whatever. So that's kind of what in my version of all this, that's exactly what they're up to. That's what they're doing, these priests, and that's why there's this rhythm. Now, to be fair, however, Lovecraft has his own established lore, I guess, of kind of a rhythm of the universe. But it tends to be more chaotic. The rhythm that he talks about is usually the horrendous piping, the tenebrous dancing and piping of the demons around Azathoth and Nyarlathotep. So to me, that doesn't sound like the same kind of rhythm that these priests are keeping. Not from the description here. And I guess we'll get more into that when I mention more about the temple, but I just wanted to mention first that to me, these are priests of Skarl. So the streets are paved with onyx of the entire city of Inquinoc, and some of them are wide and straight, whilst others are crooked and narrow. The houses near the water are lower than the rest, and bear above the curiously arched doorways curious signs of gold in honor of their respective small gods that favor each. So once again, a little bit of a divergence here. If you remember the Pagana episodes, you'll recall that the major gods do not accept prayer, but the small, so-called the home gods or the house gods, the little gods, they do, and people are meant to worship those little gods. So for the inhabitants of Inquinoc to revere respective quote-unquote small gods, again, to me, it's like Pagana is crying out to be recognized here. And as many people have said, at least online, in the limited amount of research I've done on the relationship of Dunsany and Lovecraft, They knew each other, they wrote to each other, they were pals. So, and supposedly Dunsany saw this book, the Dream Quest for the Unknown Caedith, as possibly something that was mildly inspired or by him, or that maybe possibly somewhat emulates his style. So, I don't know. I really think that this is a reference to Pagana, but obviously you can make your own decisions about that. But if you do, you have to come up with why the rhythm is being kept, the rhythm of the old ones, unless you're going to say that that's the old gods in the outer chaos, in the void. And you have to figure out who these small gods are, these small gods who all the households have above their doorway. You know, they have the signs of these small gods. So you kind of have to come up with who those would be. Now, to make all of this super interesting city even more interesting, it turns out, and this is the reason that the narrator of the story even comes to Inquinoc, but it turns out that the natives of Inquinoc, well, they generally have, they're distinct of features. So they have long, narrow eyes, long lobed ears, thin noses, and pointed chins. So, I mean, what that looks like to you can change, can mean whatever it means. To me, it sort of sounds elven a little bit, you know, almost, to me, it sounds a little bit Asian elven, if that makes sense. Like, if you think of a classic elf and combine it with sort of Eastern flavor, to me, that's what I see in my head when I think of Inquinoc. I just, for some reason, that's what I get. So, I mean, not like pale blonde elves, you know, dark elves, but not like dark elves, not like drow, just like, you know, elves who are olive skinned and dark haired. That's kind of what I see. And the reason why any of this is even getting mentioned at all is because they are the literal descendants of the gods. They are the people who supposedly live kind of very, very close to where the gods used to dwell, which is weird because they said in the book that Granic was where the gods used to dance by moonlight, and Granic is nowhere near Inquinoc. So what I kind of get is that the gods lived maybe near Inquinoc, but partied on Granic. And for a god, I assume that's pretty easy to do, because you can probably just move across the region, or the realm, in a blink of the eye. You probably have Dimension Door or something at your disposal. So Inquinoc was, or is, where the gods used to sort of dwell while in the Dreamland realm. It's not exactly stated where they used to dwell, like if it was actually in Inquinoc or somewhere just close by. We're not really sure, but the gods had been known at that time to kind of, on occasion, intermingle, that's like a euphemism for sex, with the locals of Inquinoc. And so there's genetic traces of the gods all over Inquinoc now. So a lot of the people there, they look godly. They look like divine beings, which, again, that's kind of why I kind of switch over to elves. I mean, the long face and the pointed chin and stuff, that kind of, to me, that's just kind of like classic elven features. So it's kind of an obvious choice, maybe. But just the fact that they also kind of have this strain of celestial being in them, I think it really does kind of beg for them to be some kind of elven, some kind of flavor of elf. I mean, it's up to you, obviously, but what is in the source text for sure is that they are the literal descendants of gods here. And that when you look at them, if you know what a god looks like, and you wouldn't know what a god looks like unless you'd been to the top of Granic and saw that famous carving, that picture, that image of an actual god. But if you'd seen that and then you went to Inquinoc, you would see the resemblance straight away. Okay, so Inquinoc, the region, it is famous for its onyx, obviously. It's largely, the city is kind of made out of onyx, so it's quite well known for that. That's its chief export. And they collect the onyx from these quarries further north from, further within Inquinoc, the region, so north of the city. They tend to keep mostly to themselves, which I think is kind of obvious because of how far away from everything they are. You don't just hop over to Inquinoc for a weekend. It's almost a month long trip. So they do tend to keep to themselves. But some people outside of Inquinoc kind of feel that maybe they keep to themselves because they're demigods and they kind of know it, or not, maybe not demigods, but there's a lot of godhood within the population, and they're not dumb. They know that they've got the bloodline of the gods in them, so maybe they keep to themselves partly just because they kind of feel like they're better than everyone else. So that's, no one in Inquinoc says as much in the book, but that is definitely implied that that could be one of the reasons that they do that. Everyone generally agrees that the people of Inquinoc have an aura not of Earth about them. So it is something that people, even who don't know what a god looks like, can definitely sense when they are around people from Inquinoc. The land itself is kind of interesting because when you think of certainly elves or gods or things of a divine flavor, you don't you, I think most people usually think of, gardens and things like that. Inquinoc is not that. It's a cold, twilight land. It shares a border with a land that everyone is afraid of. We'll get to that in a little while. It is isolated. It's, as I said, it's isolated from everything by the Serenarian Sea and by this high impassable mountain range along their border that may or may not lead to all kinds of nightmarish realities. Interestingly, no cat will sail on a ship bound for Inquinoc or go to Inquinoc by any means. If you can get them there by not by boat, they still won't go there. The reason for this is that Inquinoc holds shadows which no cat can endure, so that in all the cold twilight realm there's never a cheering purr or a homely mew. Whether it is because things that maybe are slightly evil in nature are sort of blowing over the mountain peaks from whatever lies beyond Inquinoc, or whether it's because it's just too cold there, no one can really say, but the cats don't go there. Now, to me, the way that I interpret that is that Inquinoc has shadows, a type of shadow that cats cannot use as portals, because we've established in Ulthar and by going to the moon, that cats can travel, the cats can use shadows as portals to other places. So Inquinoc holds shadows that no cats can endure, meaning that the shadows there are null against their magic traveling. So that's kind of how I see it. So in other words, the source text states explicitly that cats travel through the shadows. They travel extra, through the plains by shadow, by going into a shadow area and disappearing. It states explicitly that Inquinoc holds shadows that no cat can endure. So me personally, I'm putting those two things together and assuming that that means Inquinoc is basically unreachable by shadow, meaning it's also inescapable by shadow. So if a cat did go there, then they could not necessarily, their escape routes are cut off because they know that the shadows do not respond to their magic. So let's talk a little bit more about this temple in the center of the city. It is 16 carven sides on this temple. Above it is sort of a flattened dome, which I don't really know what a flattened dome means, so I assume it means like a subdued dome, and a lofty pinnacled belfry, this belfry that we keep hearing about. So within the temple is a great walled garden with streets as designed as spokes from a wheel's hub. There are 7 arched gates of the garden, and each over it has a carven face like those on the city's gates, so they're the faces of gods, and are always open. So people are free, and they do. They wander through the gardens, and they stop and worship at shrines of the lesser gods, the modest gods that get shrines within that temple. And there are fountains and pools and basins there to reflect the frequent blaze of the tripods, the flames that go off every day at prayer time or whatever it is. And as I said, this ceremonial ringing of the bell and playing of the horns and viols and chanting happens every day. People stop in reverence to honor this. And exactly what is happening, like if you had gone for a tour of the garden and were in that area when the bell went off, you would witness from 7 doors of the inner temple, there would emerge priests dressed all in black, and they would travel in single file down the lanes out along these, you know, so from the hub of the wheel, as it were, out towards 7 lodges, which is placed near the gate of each entrance to the garden. These priests, again, walking in single file, they move very peculiarly. They are very, it's very structured and very ceremonial. They strut in single file, their legs thrown far forward without bending the knee, and they walk like this, and they're holding in their hands these big golden bowls, and something is steaming in the bowl. We don't know what it is. Could just be incense, could be something completely different. We're not really sure. But the bowls are steaming, and these priests are walking very ceremoniously, and probably, I would imagine, in a very precise rhythm, down the lane, and then they kind of disappear into one of 7 lodges. You know, each row of priests will go into a different one, and they disappear into the lodges, and they just kind of never come back out. Nobody sees them again, or I mean, they may see them again, but you if you stayed in the garden and watched the door of the lodge, those priests would never come out. And yet, the next day, at prayer time, or ceremony time, whatever, the priests would emerge from the center temple again and walk down the lane into the 7 into the lodges. So it is supposed by people who bother supposing about these sorts of things in the source text, that there are probably underground paths connecting the lodges with the temple, and that the files of priests return through these underground passages back into the temple. But it is also whispered in private that maybe the lodges contain maybe even deeper flights of onyx steps going down to the mysterious depths that are never revealed by the priesthood. And there are even those who hint that the priests in the masked and hooded columns are not human beings at all. The only person allowed in the inner temple itself is known as the Veiled King, who otherwise lives within the Titan walls and mighty buttresses of a great palace situated on a hill overlooking the city. The palace is a cluster of, again, bulbous domes, and it's surrounded by these beautiful, lush gardens that, rumor has it, when visitors are admitted into these gardens, they often faint at the sight and fragrance of it. It is so beautiful. The palace gardens possess onyx terraces and colonnaded walks, elegant parterres and delicate flowering trees, and golden lattices and brazen urns and tripods with cunning bas-reliefs, pedestaled and almost breathing statues of veined black marble, basalt-bottomed lagoons tiled, fountains with luminous fish, Tiny temples of iridescent singing birds atop carven columns, marvelous scrollwork of the great bronze gates, and blossoming vines trained along every inch of the polished walls. So it's a very lush place. The palace, unfortunately, admits no visitors. The gardens might, it doesn't really say explicitly, but the palace itself, which is, I guess, why you would go into the gardens in the first place to get to the palace, it admits no visitors, and locals say that it's not wise to look too long or too steadily at the great central dome of the palace. In fact, within the central dome of the palace, it is said that there is housed the archaic father of all of the Shantak birds in existence. You don't know what a Shantak bird is yet. They're farther north, so we'll get to them. But just know that it's a terrifying beast that you don't want to mess with, and that most people have never even seen a Shantak bird. And even the people who, assuming it's all true, even the people who feed this ancient father of all Shantak birds, they feed it in utter darkness. They're not allowed to turn on lights or bring in a torch or anything like that. They have to just go into a completely pitch black room and feed a monster and then leave. Sounds like a stressful job. All right, so beyond the Gate of Caravans, which is the northern entrance into the city of Inquinoc, the roads lay straight between tilled fields lined with ligith trees and many old farmhouses crowned by low domes. The country folk of Inquinoc tend to be rather austere and a reticent sort, and it's said that these people have the greatest amount of divine blood flowing in their veins of anyone in the region. So if you want to meet a really stuck-up Inquinoc inhabitant, they're not in the city. They're out in the country. They're the country folk. They're really hard to get to. They've got a reputation for being highly religious, or at least for knowing a lot about the gods, if you can get them to talk to you at all. For not being, if you don't have godly blood in your veins, whether or not they will actually speak to you is a completely, it's anyone's guess. The common mode of transport in this region is the yak, which is popular for its mobility and its strength, especially when it's required to haul onyx from the quarries in the north. Couple of things about the countryside. There's a village called Urg, U-R-G. The village of Urg is popular among traders and miners because you can get there easily from the city, and yet it's not so far into the quarry land that you're where they're, mining all the onyx. So it's kind of a good halfway point. So in Urg, there's a caravan road heading west, towards Salarn, and the quarry road continuing north toward mining country. Salarn, I don't know anything about. All I know is that it's west of Urg. The quarry country itself, travel a full 3 days by yak from the city of Inquinoc, and you'll reach the quarry country. Here, the clouds have a phosphorescent quality, and the verdant fields of the farmlands give way to onyx quarries. Travel far enough north through this frontier land, and the inhabited part of Inquinoc pretty much peters out, sort of comes to a slow and gradual end. The road narrows to a steeply rising yak path among forbidden black cliffs, and the towering, gaunt, and distant peaks of the Langian border, ever-present and imposing on the right. The land here grows darker and colder, with only the ravens of unusual size to keep a traveler company. So, yes, as you go further north, you are essentially traveling along the mountain range that separates Inquinoc from the dreaded land of Lang, which, of course, you've heard of because they are, a lot of the people from Lang have ended up, by hook or by crook, on the moon as slaves. So there's a story there, and we'll get to that. A lot of people in the region don't, or maybe not in the region, but a lot of people, well, actually, maybe in the region, I don't know. A lot of people in the Dreamland realms don't really believe that Lang exists. They're not convinced. You know, I mean, like your average person on the road who's never seen a moon being or a Lang, a slave, an enslaved Langian, Lang folk of a moon being. They just don't believe that Lang exists. That said, a lot of people kind of have a superstitious belief that Lang lies just over the border of Inquinoc. So it's quite common for people to look at the mountain range and say, you know, don't go through those mountains. The land, you know, there's dark and evil lands beyond. Now, in reality, it is, Lang is right across the border. Luckily, the mountains sit between whatever evil lies in Lang and Inquinoc, keeping Inquinoc safe. This, for me, adds to Inquinoc's divine sense, because I feel like if there was evil in Lang, the mountains wouldn't really stand in the way. So I kind of feel like it's not the mountains that are keeping the forces from, you know, in Lang, and that, in fact, there's something about Inquinoc and its divine heritage that kind of secures those borders on its own. And that's just kind of me, but there are supposed to be questions here. There's supposed to be a mystery about Lang. So when you're traveling north, ignoring Lang for now, if you keep traveling north, you're being kept company by ravens, very large ravens, and a bunch of rock, pretty much. But if you go far enough north, you'll come across a giant's quarry, an ancient old quarry that the amounts of chunks of rock that have been removed, it just makes it obvious that the people who mined this land long ago were giants. Beyond this, the giant's quarry, the land is nearly impassable, with no path through the jagged rocks, pits, and cliffs. Most importantly, there rises from shadowy caps of mountains, and this is the mountain range of Lang now, there are these great winged, formed, bat-like creatures, except they're larger than elephants, with slippery scales instead of fur, and a head like a horse's, and these, of course, are the Shantak birds. These beasts cling to the cliffs of the region as guardians of whatever lies beyond. There are a couple of descriptions of Shantak birds, just kind of cursory descriptions in passing, really. Things like when the narrator of the story mounts one to travel over some mountains, he mentions the slippery scales and things like that. So you get a little bit here and there about the Shantak birds. It's not super solidified. I mean, it's the size of an elephant, head of a horse. I'm assuming that that's not literal. It's not just an elephant with bat wings and the head of a horse. I don't think Lovecraft probably thought that would make a terrifying beast. But at that size, I don't think you could argue that it's a full-on dragon, because, I mean, elephants are big, but they're not dragon big. And lower in physical scale than a dragon, of course, would be a drake. And so I kind of looked through some bestiaries to find a really properly horrific drake that really spoke of this region. And I was looking at the ice drakes and that sort of thing, but they all kind of felt just the flavor of them wasn't quite right. I mean, Inquinoc is a cold and kind of cold and dark and barren land, at least up in the north it is, but I just felt like an ice drake or an ice dragon or ice creature, just, I mean, they really want to be surrounded by snow and ice, you know, not just great heights. So the one that I found eventually that I really fell in love with, just so cool, is from the Kobold Press book, Tome of Beasts. That it's a great book. If you don't have a copy, you should probably pick up one. It truly is like a great bestiary. And in the pages of this tome, there are, on page 153, if you've got it, there is a drake, an Elder Shadow drake. The artwork for this one is amazing. It is absolutely gorgeous. It's kind of this scaly, armored, very bat-like drake that just, I mean, on a cliff, on the top of a cliffside, so it's kind of, it's as if though it was designed for this very purpose. So it's a large dragon-like creature with black scales and shadowy wings. Red eyes glare bright as coals, and it speaks in a deep monotone. So, the Shantak birds don't necessarily speak in the book. I mean, they do seem to understand communication, and they do seem to make some effort of communicating. I mean, they make noise, they make sounds. We don't get the idea that it is, you know, draconic or anything like that. But I don't think you would have to, I mean, I think you could pull that off. I don't think it would be completely surprising that it had intelligence. But it's important to note that these are not, I mean, this isn't like a dragon, you know, it's not, they're not necessarily solitary creatures as dragons are. They kind of hang out together on these cliffsides, guarding, we can only assume, the Elder Ones themselves. The Elder Shadow Drake is a pretty good little beast. It's got a couple of cool, really nice, perfectly suited skills that I really like. So let me just kind of go through some of them. So it's a large dragon, chaotic evil. Fits perfectly in with what they're all about. Armor class is 16, and that's all natural armor. Hit points 114, so that's 12d10 plus 48. Speed 20 feet, fly 60 feet. Strength is 22, dex is 13, constitution's 18, intelligence 8, that's about right to me. The Shantak birds, and wisdom of 9. The Shantak birds are, they're subservient. They are clearly serving some greater power, or they're actually serving as steeds, mounts for other creatures. So I don't think they're, you know, they don't have a sense of social skills or anything like that, or civilized. You know, it's not like they group together to hang out. I think they're just they're flock animals. Charisma of 13. Saving throw, dex plus 4, constitution plus 7, charisma plus 4. So they're pretty sturdy animals. Their skills are perception plus 5, stealth plus 7. That sounds about right to me. Damage vulnerabilities, radiant. Damage immunities, cold, which makes sense because they're in Inquinoc. Condition immunities, paralyzed and unconscious. That's fine by me. The interesting thing about Shantak birds is that they are actually really, really terrified of night gaunts. They just are. If they find them repulsive, they don't like them, they will avoid a night gaunt. Now, do they become paralyzed with fear? No, I don't think so. So that fits. Senses, dark vision 120 feet, passive perception 15, languages. By the book, here in the Kobold Press book, their languages are Common, Draconic, and Umbral. Umbral being a language of Shadow Elves, which is fine. In the book, in the source text, Dream Quest for Unknown Caedith, we get no sense, again, that they speak Common or Umbral, for that matter. They seem to be very animalistic, and they communicate with shrieks and grunts and things like that. And whether you want to keep that or not is up to you. Challenge rating of 7 for 2,900 experience points. Now, the cool feats, I guess, that they have, I mean, this is a 5th edition book, so I don't know if they're really feats as such, but you know what I mean. Their special attacks are Shadow Blend. In areas of dim light or darkness, an Elder Shadow Drake is treated as invisible. Artificial illumination, such as lanterns or light or continual flame spell, does not negate the ability. Nothing less than true sunlight or a daylight spell can render them visible in such conditions. So I really like this one. It's not, it isn't exactly, you know, Lovecraft didn't exactly write those words in the book, but there is a sense that these beasts blend in very well to their surroundings. It takes the narrator of the story a while to realize that they're on the cliffs, and that they're not just part of the cliffs. Shadow jump, 3 times per day. An elder shadow drake can travel between shadows as if by means of a dimension door spell. This is, like, exactly what I was saying about cats traveling through shadows, except since this is an Inquinoc, cats can't travel through those shadows because, or and as a result of, the elder shadow drakes can. This magical transport must begin and end in an area of dim light or darkness, and the distance must be no more than 60 feet. So cats, of course, we know can travel a lot more than that, but for the shadow drakes, in the elder shadow drakes in Inquinoc, they can travel up to 60 feet through these portals magically three times a day. And then they also have a skill or a feat or whatever, a speed surge, three per day. The elder shadow drake takes one additional move action on its turn. It can only use one speed surge per round. That's fine. And then it's got a bunch of various attacks, you know, bites and tail slaps and things like that, which are kind of standard for a beast like that, I think. There's also the Stygian Breath. Recharges 5 to 6. The elder shadow drake exhales a ball of black liquid that travels up to 60 feet before exploding into a cloud of frigid black mist with a 20-foot radius, dealing, 42, that's 12d6 cold damage or half damage with a successful DC 15 constitution saving throw. So that would be a lot of fun to battle, I'm sure. And it's just, it's the perfect embodiment, I think, of a Shantak bird, I really do. It looks the part, and it feels the part, because it's got all the right immunities, it's got all the right skills, it's perfect. So that's in the Kobold Press Tome of Beasts, page 153, for the Elder Shadow Drake, a great stand-in for a Shantak bird. Okay, I think that's everything for Inquinoc, and anything farther north will get us into the void, literally, and anything farther, I guess it was east after all, anything farther east would get us into the mountain range, into Lang, and that deserves an entire episode all its own. So thanks for listening, and come back soon. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.